Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host today, Jennifer Swanson. Today's episode features content from an educational program titled Contemporary Management of HIV 2021. During this podcast, Dr. Bill Short from the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia discusses initiation of first-line antiretrovirals in treatment-naive adults with HIV. For more information on Dr. Short and a link to the full online educational program, including downloadable slides specific to today's case, please visit the show notes for this episode. Now, let's get started and hear what Dr. Short has to say about a case initiating first-line ART in a patient with HIV.
All right, so let's start. So I have a man newly diagnosed with HIV. So I'm going to, you heard this earlier, but this is a 23-year-old MSM, newly diagnosed with HIV. He had discontinued the use of co-formulated FDC-TDF about 4 years ago. He was using it for PrEP and then felt the need to stop. He actually comes to you with a new diagnosis and actually wants to take a single tablet regimen. You look here and look at some of the parameters that you got back from labs. So this is someone that we did not decide to rapid start. You actually saw a provider, had labs drawn. You have a CD4 count of 340, a virus load of 67,000. Again, we talked about this earlier. He's immune to Hep B by serology, does not have Hep C. His HLA-B5701 status is positive, is a BMI of 21, no resistance mutations or resistance-associated mutations on genotype screening. ALT, AST, as you can see, transaminases within normal and for age, age-adjusted normals. And then really all of his other labs are normal. So talking about serum creatinine and everything else like that, all appears to be normal for this person. So if you look here, this is just a breakdown of what is recommended for first-line regimens for most people living with HIV. And again, remember that most people, so the majority of people coming through your practice really can fit into these categories. And these guidelines really are similar in a lot of ways, but there are some differences. So let's look at the DHHS guidelines. So all of these are recommended initial regimens. And you can see here right away, really between both sets of guidelines, that it's largely an integrase-based system here. And if you look for the IAS, it's really the second generation integrases. So it's dolutegravir and bictegravir. Whereas with the DHHS, you have mostly bictegravir and dolutegravir, but you do have that raltegravir, which as we know is the first integrase that was approved. Again, a lot of these are co-formulated, so you can get a single tablet regimen. Keep it in mind that raltegravir is twice a day. However, there is, and we'll talk about that when we talk about conceiving and pregnancy, raltegravir does come in a formulation where you can actually take that once a day. And again, you can see the smatterings of FTC or 3TC and then either versions of the tenofovir-based regimen, so TAF or TDF. And then very much more simpler with the IAS USA, they really make it simple. They really pick just the two integrase inhibitors. And again, mostly TAF-based, but again, for dolutegravir, you can do TDF. Now, for both cases, for the DHHS as well as the IAS, you'll see that there's this co-formulation that's a two-drug regimen, or what we call 2DRs, of dolutegravir 3TC. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in this first case, but keep in mind that with this and in the guidelines, there are recommendations around what patients are appropriate for that. So having a viral load that's less than 500,000, not having evidence of hepatitis B infection, because again, remember, you want to have drugs that are active against hepatitis B. And in this case, 3TC or lamivudine does have activity, but you're really lacking the other one that has activity. And then again, making sure that all this drugs are susceptible through genotypic testing. So again, that fits in both of those guidelines. So when you look here, and I'm just going to put on my glasses because I'm getting old and things are starting to blur up. But when you look here at all these trials, so this is actually what's led to these classifications of the drugs that we're talking about. And I'm not going to go through every single drug for you, but I think there's a couple things to point out. When you're looking, what you're seeing is what the integrase regimen was and what the comparator was, how many weeks the study was, and then really what was the outcome. And again, you see a lot of non-inferior studies, meaning no worse than, But a lot of these studies, as you see here, like the single study where you compared it against efavirenz, or Flamingo where you compared it against a boosted protease inhibitor, these really did favor the integrase inhibitor-based regimen. So I encourage you to look at the studies if you have time or if you're concerned, but this is really what drove a lot of those recommendations. And also when you look at rates of discontinuation. So again, you know, people always ask, why is it integrase inhibitors are first-line therapies? Well, you see here, you have the efficacy. Now look at the weeks you have durability. I mean, start mark is up to 240 weeks, and you see here with the outcomes, but also you have rates of discontinuation for adverse events are numerically lower when you look at integrases versus protease inhibitors or NNRTIs. And then also on top of that, no evidence of resistance, and that is specific to bictegravir and dolutegravir. So sort of the second generation integrase inhibitors that we talk about. That's not the case for raltegravir, where if you fail, people were failing with mutations that actually led to cross resistance to elvitegravir. So again, the data really showing why we have switched to an integrase based system. When we get to the third case, you know, not as we know, all drugs are not without issues. You know, I mean, we have this wonderful thing. We have great efficacy. We have low rates of adverse events. We have no resistance. There's got to be something, and we'll talk about weight gain when we get to the third case. So how do you choose among the integrase inhibitors? Because you really do have a choice. And depending on what set of guidelines you follow, you know, you may just say BIC or dolutegravir, but if you follow the DHHS, it's raltegravir. I think this really gives you a nice summary of the some disadvantages and advantages of each one of them. And again, I won't read these to you per se. I'll give you some of the highlights of each one. So for one, bictegravir, it's a single tablet regimen, and it's already dosed with your combination nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. Very few drug or food interactions. So that's really critical, and a high barrier to resistance. If we think back to the days when we really went with high genetic barrier drugs, we were going with boosted protease inhibitors. And most of the times they were not single tablets. There were lots of drug-drug interactions. Some of them had to be taken with food, some refrigerated, in order to get that high barrier. Here we have all that built into one without those other extra disadvantages at the time. The disadvantages, the least amount of data, it's only in a single tablet, and we have very limited data when it comes to pregnancy. Dolutegravir, as you can see here, again, very similar. It's a single tablet regimen, combined once daily with 3TC, as we saw in the guidelines, or it comes with 3TC and abacavir. We do not have a single tablet regimen where you combine it with a tenofovir-based regimen. It is few drug-drug interactions, so very similar to bictegravir, high barrier to resistance, and now it's a preferred option for pregnant women in every trimester, and we'll get to that. Disadvantages, abacavir, as we saw in our case, HLA testing is important. And then there's limited data at conception. Again, we'll get to that. I think the downside that most people are aware of with raltegravir, I think there's two. It's a BID dosing, so you're taking it twice a day, but let's just say you're gonna use the once a day formulation. You could do that, and it does have, you know, the longest experience. It was the first one approved, but it is a lower genetic barrier than bictegravir or dolutegravir. So I think, you know, you could go through this and really pick which one you think would be your best. And I think these are important to know and really take these advantages and disadvantages, discuss with your patients and figure out what's best for them. Here is also looking at some of the caveats of each. So for the integrases, you know, for bictegravir FTC-TAF, you see what it's composed of. For dolutegravir 3TC, we talked about it. Don't use if your virus load is greater than 500,000. And you may say, why is that? Well, the reason is because that's what was enrolled in the Gemini study. And when we get to that in a few minutes, you'll see that that was the cutoff for enrollment. That doesn't mean to say that there were not people who enrolled with more than 500,000. There were, if you look through the paper, but the cutoff was made and the decision was made at 500,000. Also, you know, if you have hepatitis B co-infection, you're really only using one drug that has activity. And then you need resistance testing. For the dolutegravir 3TC abacavir, only if your HLA B57-1 is negative. And then again, going down here, it really gives you a breakdown of what you're doing. For the non-nukes, most of the non-nukes come with two NRTIs, and then your single tablet regimen with booster protease. We have the first one, which is darunavir cobi FDC TAF, and that's a booster PI with dual newts. So when you look at some of the data, and I'll go through these three slides pretty fast. The AMBER trial was a treatment-naive trial that really looked at the single tablet regimen of darunavir cobi FDC and TAF versus the components. So darunavir cobi plus co-formulation of FDC and TDF. And this went out to 96 weeks. And you actually see analysis at both 48 and 96 weeks. So here is your 48 weeks in this darker blue, and then light blue is the 96 weeks. And then when you move over here to orange, and the other orange is 48 and 96. And these are the co-formulations. So your two sort of bluish colors represent the single tablet regimen, and the sort of orange and peach represent the co-formulation. And really what you could see that there was really no difference between the two. There was virologic success in 96 weeks. And really when you looked, it was consistent across all subgroups. So that's if you had a virus load greater or less than 100,000, your CD4 count was low. And they also did it with age, and they considered age greater than 50 being old. I apologize, I'm in that group now as well, sex and race. So they really did subgroup analyses on all these. And then when you looked at resistance, remember we said this booster protease inhibitors are high genetic barriers to resistance. What we saw is that one patient had an M184V in each of the arms. So not only the single tablet regimen, but also the components. And there was no evidence of resistance to darunavir or primary protease inhibitors, which is good news. This is doravirine. So it's a non-nuke with combination with two nukes versus efavirenz, or in the drive forward study, you compared it with a boosted protease inhibitor. And then that was with two nukes. And really what you see here is that in both of them, the results were non-inferior for drive ahead. And actually, if you look at drive forward, where you compared it to darunavir, not only non-inferior, but it was also superior. And when you look at the resistance analysis, what you saw was in drive ahead, again, drive ahead was comparing it to efavirenz, you saw 1.6% with doravirine versus 3.8 with efavirenz. And then for the nukes, 1.4 versus 1.6. So again, very similar. And then the same thing here for doravirine and NNRTI resistance. You had two. For NNRTI resistance, no PI resistance, you have one. And then again, lipid changes were more favorable with the doravirine regimen. So again, this is now FDA approved as well. And then Gemini was a study I talked about, and there were two identical studies, Gemini 1 and 2. They were randomized, double-blind, phase 3, non-inferiority studies in naive adults with virus loads anywhere, as I said, from 1,000 to 500,000. And really, it met both its primary and other endpoint at 96 weeks for non-inferiority. And really, what you can see here, the curves basically completely overlap. And really what the take home point is that in this study out to 96 weeks, there was no difference between two versus three drugs. And again, as we saw, there were a trend towards markers of improvement in both renal and bone safety. And then I think one of the key points is that there was no evidence of resistance. And I think that's what a lot of people's concern were, is that using two drugs, you might think 3TC is a weaker drug and people were going to get resistance to dietegavir. And at 48 week, people were like, okay, that's great. I want to see more data. And here we are at 96 weeks and we saw, and there's still no evidence of resistance. So really it's kind of reassuring news for us. When you talk about integrase versus boosted PIs as first line ART, the question is, what is the role of current boosted PIs? Where would you need that at? So if you're starting ART before the availability of resistance data, that may be a really good point to actually use a boosted PI. And if the person's at risk for poor adherence, we do have data on this for a long time now, that boosted PIs really do well in this population. Why? Because you're not going to see the develop or emergent of resistance. One of the challenges, and I think these are all the things I talked about really with the first slide as to why we switched to integrase inhibitors, One, drug-drug interactions were common, and they happen a lot of times without our knowing. So not only things we prescribe, but patients go to emergency rooms, local providers, they get referred to specialists, and you know they get put on drugs that interact. So statins and inhaled steroids and things that you know we may not know and see them 3 months later when there's an issue. There was a lot of GI tolerance, hyperlipidemia. Some of them had some cardiovascular risk. And then atazanavir was really not co-formulated. So there were some issues here with that. But again, there are some reasons why you would use a boosted PI as first line. How about NNRTIs? Again, patients experience adverse events with integrase, absolutely would be a possible role for NNRTIs. Women desire in pregnancy, and then if they're experiencing weight gain with integrase inhibitors. What are the challenges? Well, we know from a lot of the other drugs, that these have lower genetic barrier to resistance. I think very commonly, all this study showed that Wallafavirin's was a great drug, and it did well for a very long period of time. Its downside were both side effects and the development of resistance. We also know there were neuropsychiatric adverse events with efavirenz, and then higher rates in patients with viral loads, and this is for rilpivirine, with viral loads greater than 100,000 or CD4s less than 100. And that came out of the ECHO and THRIVE trials years ago. We know that rilpivirine has to be taken with a meal, and there's not always fixed dose combinations with TAF. It's combined with TDF or doravirine. Lipids do increase with efavirenz, and then there's also drug-drug interactions. We know that these tend to be potent cytochrome inducers, so you do have to worry about drug-drug interactions. I really apologize. I never cough in them. Today I'm sitting here coughing because I'm on camera. So one of the questions comes up is there still a role for TDF? We know that TAF was approved, and most of us are rushing to change patients. But really, if you stop and look through the data, I think this slide really does a really great job of summarizing what are the things that support still using TDF versus TAF. We do have much more experience and more patients who have got TDF versus TAF. And you know, for me, it's all I've known. I've used TAF forever since my training. It is co-formulated with many of the regimens we have. The lipid decreases, we really don't know the significance of it, but we did see that with TDF. And then now we're starting to see weight gain signal with TAF, and we're going to talk about that in our third case. It is a preferred nuke in pregnancy, and it is available now as generic. So there's still a good amount of data supporting TDF. What about TAF? We know in a trial comparing the two at week 144, it was superior to TDF. There's less impact on bone mineral density and markers of renal tubular dysfunction, although this is not translated clinically. Again, it's sort of a proof that this really does help to decrease some, may potentially decrease some of the renal dysfunction we see. And then the nice part, I think, is that the low dose actually allows small tablets when you make these co-formulations. How about abacavir? Well, what's supporting it is co-formulated with dietegravir. We have a long history of its use. And I love this one. It's not renally cleared. This comes up all the time. What are the best drugs to use for patients who, as they progress from, you know, someone who had normal creatinine clearance and now they have chronic kidney disease onto dialysis, you know, we need drugs that are not renally cleared, and abacavir is one. The opposing side is that you do need a test. The HLA test, and if it's positive, they can't use it. You have to list it as an allergy. And then an older ACTG study that really demonstrated high rates of virologic failure, and that was greater than anyone that had a viral load of more than 100,000. Now, for the most part, we're not using the two drugs that they've studied with, but that was efavirenz or boosted atazanavir. And it's interesting enough, when we actually did these studies with dietegravir, you did not see the same effect. So it was just when you're using abacavir with efavirenz or boosted atazanavir. And then there's still evidence about the risk of a myocardial infarction, and there's more AEs versus TDF and TAF. So still reasons you can sort of go back and forth with your approach to what you would want to do and treat the patient with. So I think the key take-home points from this case are all preferred initial regimens. contain an unboosted integrase inhibitor with NUCs. We know that. Dolutegravir and BIC have higher genetic barriers than raltegravir. The co-formulation of FTC-TAF has improved safety tolerability when compared to FTC-TDF and abacavir 3TC, but it may be associated with greater weight gain that we're going to talk about. Dolutegravir 3TC is really recommended by the guidelines, both sets alongside three-drug ARTs, and you saw the data showing that the curves really were superimposable out to 96 weeks. There are potential AEs with integrase, include weight gain, CNS adverse events, and then a small risk to newborn if taken at the time of conception. And then there's several single tablet regimens available now representing all ARV classes since we've had the introduction of a single tablet booster protease inhibitor. So let's go back to our case and we're gonna take a vote on it here. So again, you're seeing the 23-year-old MSM, newly diagnosed. He had discontinued PrEP 4 years ago. You do lab results. Now there's a new diagnosis of HIV. He's HLA-B5701. It's positive. No drug resistance mutations. CD4 is 340. Virus load 67,000. Hep B immune. Hep C negative. All other lab work is normal. And you want to select a regimen for him. So here you go. So if you're selecting the Department of Health and Human Services recommended first-line regimen, all of these are first-line except which one? And so the correct answer is doravirine 3TC TDF. So remember, if you look at first-line regimens, first of all, is that all of them are integrase-based. So bictegravir, raltegravir, dolutegravir. So right off the bat, it would be these two. So this is a non-nuke, and it would not be included.
Great. Thank you very much to Dr. Short, and thanks to listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full educational program, Contemporary Management of HIV 2021, on the Clinical Care Options website, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. And please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on infectious disease topics. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.